Well, we're just a little bit behind this morning. Kind of got everybody got a little chatty, myself included, and look up, and it's a little bit after 10. Make your way over to Ruth chapter 1, if you would, please. Ruth chapter 1. We almost made it through 5 verses last week, so we're going to progress a little more today. The first 5 verses were a little more critical to the story. We're going to see some more, but there's good discussion that we'll be able to have along the way. So we do want to read the first 5 verses and kind of set the stage for the story that's building. And we'll do that here in just a moment, but we're going to open up with a... we're just going to have that verse on the screen. Open up with a word of prayer. Loving Father, how grateful we are for this day, for its beauty, for your creation that surrounds us, that points so clearly towards your existence. And we see in creation, Father, your mighty power and your love for us, and the beautiful world that you've made and placed us in. We pray that you would be with us in this time of study. May we remove the things of the world from our mind. And may we focus upon your word. May we allow it to enter into our hearts. And may we walk by it, and may we be guided by it, and may we subject ourselves to it. We thank you for the beautiful story of Ruth, for the lessons from it that we can learn in loyalty and faithfulness. And pray that you would help us to emulate the faith of Ruth. And may we, as your children, live in such a way that brings honor and glory to you. May our time be spent well together. May we focus on the lessons that we learn. May we allow your word to speak to us, to build us up, and to strengthen us in salvation. This is our prayer in Jesus' name. Amen. So let's start with verses 1 through 5 again. And we won't rehash the things that we've said much, but we'll get started and at least lay the foundation for our text and for our story, and then we'll progress pretty quickly through those first few verses and on to the rest of the chapter. It came about in the days when the judges governed the land, that there was a famine in the land, and a certain man of Bethlehem in Judah went to sojourn in the land of Moab with his wife and his 2 sons. The name of the man was Elimelech, and the name of his wife was Naomi. And the names of his 2 sons were Mahlon and Chilion, Ephrathites of Bethlehem in Judah. Now they entered the land of Moab and remained there. And then Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left with her 2 sons. They took for themselves Moabite women as wives. One was named Orpah, and the name of the other Ruth. And they lived there about 10 years. Then both Mahlon and Chilion also died, and the woman was bereft of her 2 children and her husband. And so we kind of have the foundation of the story laid for us here. Well, we talked last week a little bit about the decision that Elimelech made in going to Moab. And we talked about the country of Moab. You'll remember that they were very disfavorable in the sight of the Israelites because of the incestuous origin that they began with Lot and that relationship with his daughters, their rejection of Israel to pass through the land when they're wandering after they had left Egypt, and recently the oppression from King Eglon, which in the time of the judges, Eglon was the oppressor over the children of Israel for a time. That would be fresh on their mind. And then the children of Israel, we consider how Balaam helped lead them into idolatry through the enticement of the Moabite women. By intermarrying with the race, they were led away from the Lord, and the Lord punished them quite severely for that idolatry. So when we come to Moab at this point in time in Israel's history, there's quite a bad taste in the people's mouth from recent things that have happened all the way back to the Moabites' origin. And remember in Deuteronomy, there's that passage that says they were so distasteful in the eyes of the Lord that God says no Moabite or no Ammonite to the 10th generation can enter into the presence of the Lord. And so they were forbid from the holy places, even if they had just a small portion of Moabite blood in them. So greatly was Israel's distaste for this nation. And so it's quite surprising when we come to Elimelech, who decides during this time of this famine, well, I'm going to make a trip to Moab. And I think we're going to have a map that shows us that trip. It would have been about a 10-day trip. But they're trying to flee the famine in hopes of finding some comfort and some relief in the land of Moab while he's there. He ends up dying, and his 2 sons, Mahlon and Chilion, they take Moabite women. This would be a very, very disfavorable, once again, in the sight of the people. When you go back and you read, Moab wasn't, per se, one of the nations that Israel was commanded not to intermarry with. However, the purpose that God made for the 7 nations, he said, you shall not intermarry with them, was because if you do, they're going to lead you into idolatry, and they're going to lead you further away from me. And definitely, we'd seen that happen with the Moabites. already. And so while this marriage wasn't a violation of the letter of the law, it definitely was a violation of the spirit of God's law, which was to protect the purity of his people's religion and his people's faithfulness to him so they wouldn't be drawn away. And we talked about, is it wise or unwise for a Christian to marry someone who is an unbeliever? And the answer to that is you don't see that as listed as a prohibition in the Bible. Some people draw that line. I don't believe it's there. I don't believe you have good evidence to make that a prohibition. But at the same time, as I think about the number of faithful women or faithful men who have converted their spouse who was an unbeliever, and as we read the story here of Ruth, then I think this kind of stands in opposition to the idea. However, wisdom would seem to dictate, be very careful for the person you marry, because that person is going to make your life a whole lot easier to serve the Lord or a whole lot more challenging to serve the Lord. So we see these two sons take these Moabite women. They live about 10 years in the land of Moab. They have no children, and they die. And that really sets the stage for the book, because you've got this woman who was full when she left Jerusalem, not physically, but in the sense that her progeny was going to be perpetuated through the generations. She's now on the brink of her name dying out and being removed from God's people. So she has no male heir. She has no husband. She's beyond the age of childbearing years. And God had even made provision for the people with what was called the Levirate Law, meaning if your spouse died, if a woman's husband died, and she didn't have any male children, then his brother or the closest of kin was to take her as a wife and was to raise up an heir for her brother so that his name might not die out. That's commanded by God. And Naomi's beyond the age of that. So there's not just a lot of hope. She's in quite a desperate and hopeless situation from all appearances. And so it's at this point in time, as we're going to continue reading, that she's going to decide it's time for me to go back to Bethlehem. So anyone want to make any statements or observations about those first few verses before we move on to verses 6 through 14? All right, well, let's continue in our text. We see the problem laid before us here with Naomi, and the story is going to work toward building a solution for Naomi and her circumstances, being bereft of a husband and children. Then she arose with her daughters-in-law, that she might return from the land of Moab. For she had heard in the land of Moab that the Lord had visited his people by giving them food. And so she had departed from the place where she was, and her two daughters-in-law with her, and they went on their way to return to the land of Judah. And Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, "Go and return, each of you, to your mother's house. May the Lord deal kindly with you as you have dealt with me, with the dead and with me. May the Lord grant that you may find rest, each in the house of her husband." And then she kissed them, and they lifted up their voices and wept. And they said, "No, but we will surely return with you to give not to your people." But Naomi said, "Return, my daughters. Why should you go with me? Have I yet sons in my womb, that they may be your husbands? Return, my daughters, go. For I am too old to have a husband. If I said I have hope, if I should even have a husband tonight and also bear sons, would you therefore wait until they were grown? Would you therefore refrain from marrying? No, my daughters, for it is harder for me than for you. For the hand of the Lord has gone forth against me." And they lifted up their voices and wept again. And Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clung to her. So let's talk a little bit about the circumstances that Naomi and Ruth and Orpah would find themselves in. What challenges did widows face during these days? Tommy?
Much different from today. A woman's options were very limited at that time in order to keep a part of living for yourself.
Very limited. In fact, many women would have to, if in such a situation, they'd have to resort to the work of prostitution just so they could simply have enough to live. And it was either that or die. And it's quite tragic and quite terrible, and that's why it was so significant for a woman to have an heir. But this is the circumstance Naomi finds herself in. So a widow was quite a terrible position to be in, wasn't it? So you lose your social status. I'm sorry, Miss Johnny.
Criticized for living outside of home, especially during this time.
You're right. And it hasn't been until relatively recent years that that change was brought about. And there have been some good things that have happened because of it, haven't there? You know, women don't find themselves, widows don't find themselves in such a hopeless situation. Something happened to their husbands. And nowadays, women are getting the same educations. Women are able to, by and large, do many of the same jobs that men are able to do. But have you noticed perhaps any bad things that have come about? To me, it seems like it's a two-edged sword. You know, on one hand, it's a good thing that women are able to provide care for themselves in the event that they're widowed or they don't marry or they choose not to marry or whatever the case may be. But on the other hand, you got some people that are just going to the extreme with it. And you go back to Genesis and you find really the order of creation that God sets forth. The husband's to be the leader and the wife is to be the helper in that relationship. And that's by no means demeaning, but that's just the role that God has given. And because of the things that have came about, and yes, in a sense, you know, things have changed for the better on one hand, but some women take that to the extreme and having children at home, they neglect them in favor of working, or they neglect them in favor of a worldly pursuit. And while you won't find me condemning any woman who chooses to work outside the home, I think we need to have wisdom and exercise that in such a way that as long as she's able to fulfill her responsibility to her household and to her children, and the same would go for the husband for that matter. He can get so caught up in working that he neglects his responsibility. But you need to measure that with caution. And we live in such a materialistic age where, by and large, you do see that. And in some cases, almost, it seems like both the husband and the wife need to work. Otherwise, things will go under. But I would really point toward the materialism and people having things that they didn't necessarily need. So that is good on one hand, that change has come about. But it's quite different for widows today than it was back then. Dave? Yeah, that's a good point. And the judges, is we find out this is the time frame from when this happened. This is a very dark day during Israel. And those last few chapters of Judges really help us see how terrible it was spiritually, how deprived Israel had come. And you're right, Dave. The book of Ruth is meant to be a breath of fresh air for us. And it's to show us that, yes, despite the fact that many of the men and many of the women had strayed from what God had intended, and you know, you bring out a good point. Even whenever you find such terrible situations like that, that's not God's intention. You've got their men failing to do what they're supposed to do, and in turn, women have, in some of those instances, women having to resort to the terrible behaviors and terrible actions just that they're almost in a sense driven to. But you're right, Ruth gives us a ray of hope, and it shows us what an industrious woman can accomplish, and it shows us what a woman of faith can do in those hard times, and that's an important lesson, and that I think should stand as the example, you're right, rather than the other. So thank you for bringing that. David?
You know, it seems like then as now, it's always worse for the woman if she's involved in that kind of behavior than it is for the guy that you know, is coming to visit her. The woman's a lifelong scar. It's something you always remember with the guy. It's just something, just a mistake they made. Here a while back, there was this website that, I can't remember what the name was, it tried to get people had affairs.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, there was a couple of
people. I'd be worried if you knew the name of that, by the way. Mm-hmm.
All over. There were two people in Texas County that I sell mature to. His name was on that list. And
really?
Wow.
You
know, it's just a. Everybody talked about it for about a week or two, and then next thing you know, they're still down there, good old buddies, and they're still building houses. And they're just. It's just not the same for a guy to get involved in that as it is for a woman. It's a lifelong scar, it seems like for a woman, for a guy, it's just a mistake.
You're right. And even today, it seems to be something that's never changed. And it's just as hideous as a practice, you're right, as a woman who has to resort to that, and perhaps her intentions are more noble. The man's just simply seeking pleasure, but the woman's trying to survive. And, you know, she's left with something. It seems to have been that way, you know, all the way back here. And, you know, you make bring that point, and that's there's some truth to that. But I like the way that Ruth really shows us that women can rise above that. And at the core of what Ruth does, and this is an important lesson. At the core of what Ruth does in rising above her circumstances is faith in God. It's faith in God and loyalty to her mother-in-law. And it's all of those good attributes, loyalty, faith, love, compassion. Those are the things that drove Ruth to do the things that she did. And the Lord, what you find out, the Lord blesses those people who have that kind of faith. So the book of Ruth is great for us as an example. And you know, although yes, there were challenges that were faced by widows, there were the loss of the social status, the loss of the protector, the loss of the provider, becoming economically dependent upon society, and compassion by and large was lacking in Israel during the days of the judges. Mainly we're looking at those who were trying to extort others and take advantage of them. Widows were in a very bad spot. And this is why Naomi's complaint is so great in this circumstance, that she's left without a husband and without any children or grandchildren. She's left without an heir because she realizes how terrible it is. And I think it's because of this that she urges her daughters-in-law to go back to others. So in verses 6 and 7, we see word reaches Naomi while she's still in Moab that the famine in Bethlehem had ended and the people now had food to eat. You know, I really like the perspective of Old Testament reading. What you find out in the Old Testament, everything's attributed to God, just about that. Because and I've tried to kind of incorporate that into my life. We can't know whether God is truly involved in something, whether it be providentially, or whether perhaps it's simply time and chance that occurs that the writer of Ecclesiastes tells us about. And the only way that we can know the difference between time and chance and providence is if God's Word reveals that. And since God does not communicate through in the same sense that He did many years ago, we can't know the things in our life, whether they come about simply because of time and chance or the providential hand of God. But just as you read through the Old Testament especially, you just find out God's the one that gets credit for everything. And so I've tried to incorporate that to the way that I live, simply because of the view that God is to be the center of our life. And so, you know, although we can't know time and chance from providence, just attribute everything to God. all those good things anyway, that is. So God, when we find out that we see that perspective in she had heard from the land of Moab that the Lord had visited her people by giving them bread. And so the bread wasn't the result of the end of the famine, the rain coming down, the grain growing, the harvest coming, and bread being made. That wasn't how someone with a biblical perspective would view that. God visited her people by giving them bread. And so carry with you that perspective perhaps. And so providence is the key theme, or a key theme in this book. And we see providence in the sense, word gets to Naomi that God has visited His people again by providing for them. So she decides to pick up and return. Somebody want to give me a definition of providence real quick? We're going to talk about that a lot in our study. Kind of an abstract thought that's hard to put words to. I think it's a word that we all know but and understand, but we may not be able to put a definition to it. I kind of say it as such. It's the working of God within the natural world without divinely intervening. You know, we think of miracles that occur in the New Testament, and many times a miracle was a suspension of the divine laws that God has put forth. And in fact, that by definition, a miracle is a violation of the laws of nature. And providence is God working within the world as He has created and then the natural laws that govern the world, bringing about His purposes. And so you, providence is a deep subject. But you see it here as you got a woman who is without husband, without children, without sons, and this widow follows her. You see the providential hand of God. He's not really mentioned, but behind the scenes, He's governing all of this and bringing about what it is He desires. So remember how Judges ended. There was no king in Israel. Every man did what was right in his own eyes. And the book of Ruth proposes a solution for the fact that there was no king of Israel. And is going to bring about and conclude with a king who comes about through the lineage of Ruth and Naomi. So you see providence, God working within the natural world without violating the laws. You see that time and again in the book of Ruth. So we don't know how much time has passed. It's been a minimum of 10 years. That's how long Mahlon and Chilion had been married to the women. And by the way, once again, maybe that was God's judgment upon them for taking Moabite wives. They remained barren 10 years, no children, and ultimately they died in the land of Moab. So it's been at least 10 years since they've been in Moab, probably longer. And so what's turned out to be a temporary sojourn has turned into quite a lengthy visit. And so Naomi begins the journey back to Bethlehem, and both Ruth and Orpah pack up and decide that they're going to go with her. Why do you think they were so attached to their mother-in-law? Been interested to hear somebody's thoughts on this. Why might that have been? Dave? Okay. And you think Naomi might have been quite different in character than the people, Moabites, that they were used to being around?
So, I would think so. There's got to be something there.
Something, you know?
There's something better than they've been used to seeing.
That's good. I mean, if you think of, remember, she's poor. She has no protector. She has no provider. They're willing to up and go with her and to give up everything that they know. This is quite a sacrifice that these two women are willing to make. And so I think character is a good word that describes it, maybe especially in contrast to what they were used to seeing in the Moabite women. You're right, and after 10 years, you know that they had to have some sort of influence on one another, right? At least 10 years, maybe longer. So something about Naomi caused this unnatural attraction and desire for them to both go to her. Tommy, were you going to make a comment?
Yeah, you got to remember during that time and place, many generations lived in the same house. So more than likely, her two sons and their wives lived with her.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. She loved her with
you're right.
And they loved her.
And I think what you're saying ties in with what Dave was saying. Her character was made known after spending all that time together. And because of that, they were drawn to her. So that created this love. Cole, were you going to say something? Miss Johnny? That says a lot. Because what Naomi's going to encourage her daughters-in-law to do, she's going to say, go back to your mother's house. And this woman that had raised them, this Moabite woman that had raised them, whoever she may have been, their love for Naomi was greater than it was for their own mother. For that mother mattered their father, their brothers, their friends, their comfort, their home, their stability, all of the things that they would have enjoyed if they simply would have turned back. And Ruth particularly, her love for her mother-in-law was greater than all of those other things that so many would have chosen. So.
She went back to her people and to her gods, back to them. And I'm thinking that they only influence the Moabite women, you know, for worshiping the God. But it was kind of hard for me to accept that she encouraged them to go back.
Well, we're going to talk about why she made that statement later, Steve. You bring I think that's verse 15, maybe?
Yeah.
And it's an interesting statement why... A worshiper of God would make such a statement as that, and we'll talk about that a little more, but there may be something to that. I will say this, it was common for if two people got married, one was a worshiper of God and the other was a worshiper of a foreign God, it was common for the woman who came into the marriage. Nowadays we see sometimes that happening, and either the husband or the wife will compromise and say, okay, we'll go worship with your faith, or we'll go with mine, or we'll find one in the middle, or something like that. It seems that they primarily would cling to their native deity. You see that with Jacob and Rachel. Although Jacob is a believer in God, and he has all these promises from God as he's beginning to reveal himself, Leah actually converts to the faith of Jacob, I believe. Rachel, on the other hand, she carries her father's idols. And you see that with Solomon as well. When he married many of the foreign women, they all worshiped their idolatrous gods. And actually, that ended up causing him to be led away into idolatry as well. You don't see the conversion to Jehovah very often, but you do oftentimes see it in the other direction. As to whether they converted or not, I believe that Ruth is going to. Whether she is converted at this point in time, and whether the Lord's or Naomi's faithfulness to God was a contributor, it may have been, may not have been. I do believe that at least the things that bled over into her character, the kindness, the compassion, the loyalty, the faithfulness, I believe that those things definitely influenced their attachment to her. But as to, you know, whether they were converts to Judaism, you know, that's going to ultimately happen for Ruth. But whether at this point in time in the story it has or not, we'll see. But you bring out an interesting point. We're going to talk about verse 15 a little bit later on. Anybody else want to chime in on this one? Okay. Here's a little question for some application. Yeah, this is, I think, a good place to go, to see that relationship between the daughter-in-law and the mother-in-law. And today it's almost stereotypical that we joke about that relationship with one's mother-in-law, because I guess so oftentimes it's one that's been soured just for any number of reasons. And so we almost expect, in a sense, there to be some tension between the mother-in-law and the daughter-in-law. But Ruth tells us a completely different story. And Dave, you pointed out earlier, the book of Ruth, she breaks the mold for so many things. And she's light, and she's faithfulness, and she's industrious. And I think here we see a break of the mold from the typical mother-in-law, daughter-in-law relationship, which may be a bit tense sometimes, maybe a bit precarious, and maybe just downright unpleasant in some circumstances. And so as we look at these two as examples, you know, I would ask, and maybe someone can share some insight that they have, how do you create that strong daughter-in-law and mother-in-law relationship? And how do you preserve that? And I don't ask for my benefit, but there are many young ladies here who have that relationship with the mother-in-law, and I think this is truly a wondrous thing to have. And so if we can talk about this and help you build that relationship, then that's great. Anybody want to jump in on this? Am I just going to assume that your relationship with your mother-in-laws are poor? Tom?
Love
and time. Okay, we see both of those come into effect. Miss Johnny?
Well, the mother-in-law, you know, the daughter-in-law, her place with her husband. I mean, he may be her son, but she can't assume the important place in his life once he marries. She has to have the important place in his life. And not, the mother-in-law doesn't need to take over that.
I think there's a lot of wisdom in that. What was it that was said in Genesis 3? Leave father and mother and cling to your wife. And so I can understand that would be a challenge, to have been in that position of influence and adoration, a mother and her daughter, for many years, 18 years today, longer and beyond, and then have to step back and let somebody else fill in that position. Mom, were you going to? Okay, of course, the Lord would be a strong factor. And if both women are Christian, that definitely makes things easier. You know, you have that common bond beyond that which is created by marriage, but you have that relationship with God at the center. And so, you know, all of those things kind of help build and strengthen that relationship. And definitely, I would believe, from the perspective of a mother-in-law and a daughter-in-law, an enviable thing that we see here when we see such loyalty and love from these two young women on behalf of their mother-in-law and she to them. David?
I don't think your time got a lot to do with that, because I know in my own situation, the older I get, the smarter my in-laws get too. They spend a lot of time together, they see time together, it changes things, and they see things and learn things.
Time definitely has to have some influence on it. I think there's a natural resistance perhaps, but then as the marriage grows, and maybe the mother sees, or the mother-in-law sees that, okay, she can care for my son, and she can provide. But there has to be, I think, also a sense of humility to take a step back and to place himself and to take that role of being in the back burner. That can't be something that's easy to do. And so that may be why time is so critical to that the forging and the building of that relationship strongly. It's not just something you can dismiss in a moment. But it takes time and persistence and patience and humility and all of those things. So, David, Dave?
Good sense takes place too, because if you look at, if you contrast Ruth with Orpah, one had better sense than the other. One could look ahead and see the lessons of life that were being presented to her by her mother-in-law and appreciate them for what they were. But could go so far, but couldn't go further. Somewhere in her character, she just said, nah, I think I'll just go into the one way.
Okay. Okay. Well, and I was gonna bring it out later, but I'll go ahead and bring it out now since you kind of bring it up. We only got a couple minutes left. I've heard, and you didn't do this, Dave. I'm not saying this about you, but you bring us into a point where I can ask this question. I've heard Orpah get kind of a bad rap here, and statements made regarding her character. Do you think Orpah's really that bad of a girl from what we read here? I mean, based off of this decision. I mean, I don't see it. I see. I know she's criticized in Scripture or by people quite a bit. You're right. She did cling to Ruth for a time. But go ahead. I asked a question. I don't want to answer it. And that's good. That's a good observation. I think because she was willing to go, wasn't she? But we'll talk about that a little bit. You know, the vehemence with which Naomi tries to encourage the people to return. Okay. Well, I'm looking forward to hearing what y'all have to say about that. I thank everybody for their participation and your attention in our class this morning. So we'll pick up. We'll pick up in verses 6 through 14 and have a few more things to say and then move on to 15 through 18.